Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, March 20th, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call on Murr v. Wisconsin, a regulatory takings case that was argued this morning at the Supreme Court. My name is Tim Courtney. I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Misha Saitlin, the Solicitor General of the State of Wisconsin, and James S. Burling, who is Vice President of Litigation at the Pacific Legal Foundation. Our experts will discuss the case and the oral arguments, and then we will take audience questions. Thanks for speaking with us today. James, the floor is yours.
Thanks. And so this is probably one of the most important property right cases for several years at the Supreme Court. It deals with the intersection of the ownership of adjacent lots and government regulation. Now, many people own adjacent lots. A farmer may acquire a neighboring farm with the hope that his children can live next door. Or a person, as happened here, might fall in love with a vacation home and buy an empty lot next door. What happens when new zoning laws declare those lots to be too small and substandard? If the government denies the use of one parcel, can it avoid any takings liability simply because the owner happens to own the next door property? And that's the question that was argued today in Murr versus State of Wisconsin. Here, the Murrs own two adjacent lots on the St. Croix River. Their parents purchased one lot in the 1960s, and they built a small 950-square-foot cabin on it. And they loved it. So 3 years later, 1963, they bought a second lot. Both lots are an acre and a quarter, more or less, and things went swimmingly well for many, many years. Now, in around 76, new regulations are passed, making the lots nonconforming, because after setbacks for waterfront and slope center were added in, each lot had less than an acre of buildable area. The two lots together had 0.98 acres of buildable area. Now, if different individuals own the lots, each person would be able to separately or sell these two lots under a grandfathered clause. That is, we'll call one lot F, where the cabin is, and one lot E, which is the investment lot. And there was an exception to these new regulations from the 1970s, and that is for an individual who owned the lots who was too small to develop on. They're allowed to develop the property because undoubtedly the state and the county realize that it would be too harsh and potentially a takings if use were disallowed on one lot. But there is an exception to the grandfather clause, and the exception is for somebody who owns the next door property. The children want to sell the unoccupied property, and they could sell it, according to the appraisal, for about $410,000. They want to sell it in order to raise money to make badly needed repairs on the cabin, but they cannot. And they think that they have been taken of their interest to sell this property. But the county and the state and the federal government, in various and varying arguments, argued that no, there is, you should not look simply at the individual lot by itself, that you have to join these three lots together. And let me be clear, the arguments of the state and the county and the federal government were very different in some respects. We'll get into that in a bit. But the bottom line from the Murr's position is that these lots are separate. They had certainly initially, when they were purchased in the 1960s, thought they were separate. Now, the problem is that the county has decided these are, in the lower court below, decided these were effectively merged by the regulations, and that the children can only think of these lots and only be treated by the government as if they were a unified single lot, although they're still deeded separately, and for many years they were taxed separately until this litigation began. And they're arguing that we don't really care if we could build on the two lots together. We want to be able to sell the investment lot. Well, the state points out that, you know, if you were able to sell the two lots separately, it might be worth $700,000+. And if you sell them and if you have to look at them together, you only lose 9% of the total value. But the children, the Murr children, said that doesn't help us. The Murr children acquired these two lots in 1995, and they acquired them under single unified ownership, whereas the parents bought one as their plumbing company and one as their personal investment, essentially the same thing, but they were technically, legally separate. And so today the children are saying we still want to consider them separate, although there was unified ownership from 1995, because telling us that we can merge the lots and then build a big home on them doesn't do us any good. We want to stay on the property. We want to improve the cabin, but we can't do that. So the question before the court is, in a claim of a taking, what is the relevant parcel? The Penn Central decision from a number of years ago, the court said that you should begin by figuring out what the property interest at stake is. What is the relevant parcel? Is it everything somebody owns? In the Penn Central case, that was dealing with a railroad terminal in New York City that wanted to build above the terminal but was not allowed to. The court rejected the idea that you should consider the other parcels that the railroad owned in the vicinity, including a hotel next door. They said, no, no, you're going to look at the railroad parcel, but you cannot separate out the air rights from the terminal itself. Those need to be considered together. So it really did not answer the question in a situation like this where somebody owns two adjacent lots. So we had oral argument on this case today, and the argument was a very, as often the case, a lively bench. We made the argument that we should start with the presumption that when you have a separately deeded and plotted lot, the presumption is that these are separate lots and they should not be joined together. The presumption can be overcome sometimes. For example, if you could clearly show, and this is not, we didn't argue it this way, but this is an example, if you could clearly show that the lots are really so small that they would be a nuisance to develop them together, too small for a septic system, for example, then it may be that you don't have a property right, sort of a nuisance, to use these properties separately. That may be a time when a court might look at the two parcels together, or you may have a situation, as we argue today, where one lot could be a parking lot and the other lot could be a hotel, with a hotel being served by the parking lot. In a case like that, it may be quite appropriate that the lots be merged together. But here, the argument is that the parcels are separate. So there were a lot of questions from the bench. I would consider it a very hot bench. Kennedy began by asking questions on valuation of what if the two lots together were each worth $100,000. I mean, if separately were $100,000, but together were much more, they were $500,000. And I think the answer is, in this particular case, if the MERS wanted to develop and sell only one lot, they were not interested in the assembly value, then you look at the value of the independent lot that they are trying to sell. You had some questions dealing with, well, the fact is when they acquired these properties in 1995 from their parents when they were joined together, they were on notice of the regulation, right? And the answer is, well, notice is not the be-all and end-all of these questions. In the Palo Zolo case, the Supreme Court, that was one that I argued 15 years ago, and Justice Kennedy said, just because you acquire property subject to regulation doesn't mean you cannot sell, you cannot argue that there's been a taking. The transfer of property from one owner to the next doesn't change the fundamental nature of the property right. You cannot alter property rights simply through sale. On the other hand, some members of the court, Kagan, for example, was saying, well, it doesn't really matter because Palo Zolo said you could bring a taking claim, but it doesn't mean that that's all it means. You can still bring a taking claim, but you're going to win. One of the fundamental arguments that we, representing the MERS, were trying to impress the court with, that a lot of the questions and tests proffered by the state and St. Croix and the federal government go really to the question of whether or not there's been a taking. You look at investment fact expectations, but that's in the context of whether or not there's a taking. You look at the economic impact in the context of determining under Penn Central whether there's been a taking. But our argument essentially comes down to the fact that before you enter into this analysis of whether or not there's a taking, you have to define what the property is. Is it one lot that you're arguing that's been taken or two lots? And our argument essentially comes down to the fact that the more, it should not be a rule that the more you own, the more government can take. the more you own, the government simply can't come in and steal your property, saying, hey, you own more than one lot. It's quite clear in this case, if an other individual owned this investment lot, an individual that could have been husband and wife owning lots next to each other, it's quite clear that if you own simply one lot, you could develop or sell this property, but because the MERS own the adjacent lot, you cannot. And we think that's fundamentally unfair. So the other side, also, the argument was split three ways for this position, or the side of the county arguing for affirmance. First of all, you had the state of Wisconsin, argued by Misha, who will be talking and speaking with us next. And Misha probably can describe his argument more accurately than I can. But the state of Wisconsin has an argument that, you know, it's not a let me put it this way. It begins by saying that the decision from the Court of Appeals below, nobody really agrees with completely, because the decision of the Court of Appeals below is that there's a bright line test that whenever you have two adjacent properties, they have to be considered together. And the state certainly has not been arguing that case. The state is arguing what I call for a more nuanced position than that, arguing that you really have to, you know, look at a number of different things in determining whether or not the property has been taken. And the state of Wisconsin's argument is, they're all wrong from my standpoint, of course. I'm saying that somewhat tongue-in-cheek because we argued for the MERS. But the state of Wisconsin's argument is probably the less radical of the arguments, but still I think it's one that should not, hopefully not prevail. The county, represented by Richard Lazarus, was arguing for a standard that I think would completely mix up the question of what a taking is with the question of what the underlying property is. And finally, the federal government was arguing for a rather unique, sui generis case that you have to look at the spatial, temporal, and functional values and nature of the property before you can determine whether or not there's a taking. It's an interesting theory that I think perhaps belongs in a law review article, but really is not usable doctrine that anybody can use. I appreciate the Department of Justice, and it was Elizabeth Preliger that argued for them. It was making a very forceful argument, but whether or not that one is the one that's essentially accepted by the court remains to be seen. So to conclude, we had a very hot bench with strong arguments on all sides. When the side supporting affirmance of the decision below, there were a lot of tough questions from Justice Alito, a lot of tough questions from the Chief Justice, and more softball questions, if you will, from Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor, only a little bit from Ginsburg, and Kennedy's questions were a little enigmatic to read what he was really thinking, as often is the case with Justice Kennedy. There were arguments that the Palazzolo decision should be looked at by our side and should carry the day as far as what the notice issue is. And since Kennedy wrote that decision, I'm hopeful that he will understand that. But I think it's pretty much impossible to tell right now whether this is going to be a 5-3, one direction or the other, or a 4-4 argument, or whether it's the sort of argument that the chief is going to say, we should do something different here and maybe wait until we have a new Supreme Court justice either to decide or maybe to re-argue the case, depending, of course, what happens with the Gorsuch hearings this week. So that's my opening presentation, and I think, Misha, now it's probably your turn.
Thank you so much. As was mentioned, I did the actual oral argument today for the state of Wisconsin. So with apologies, I haven't prepared the kind of excellent, fulsome remarks that were just delivered. I'm just going to give a couple of thoughts and then kind of respond to questions. First, I will say that I think the Pacific Legal Foundation, which represented the MERS here, does fantastic work. They do really critical litigation on behalf of property owners. And I think this is probably the first time I've ever disagreed with them in a case. And I think that's not just because of the party I was representing. And so there are a lot of factual nuances in this case, which perhaps might not be the most interesting for the people on this call. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to summarize what I view as the party's methodological approaches to the parcel question and try to explain why I think the state's approach is not only correct, but it's actually more protective of property owners' rights than even the Pacifica Legal Foundation's approach. So the way I understand the Pacifica Legal Foundation's approach is that you get a presumption based upon lot lines, but not anything else under state law. You kind of just look at lot lines as the only thing that matters under state law. And then you can back away from that based on a rebuttable presumption. And Justice Sotomayor asked John Groen, the counsel for Pacifica Legal Foundation today, is there any limit on what could be used as part of the rebuttable presumption? And there was no limit given. So in fact, what the test comes down to is it puts, you know, a favor in front of only one aspect of property of state law, which is property owners, and not which is lot lines. But then it allows basically a limitless attempt to rebut it based on all of the factors that could possibly be involved. Now, the federal government doesn't have any sort of presumption. They just say, look at everything in the world, and you can just decide. That obviously doesn't give a thumb on the scale either way, but it's completely unguided, and it's not going to create any predictability for either property owners or for regulators. It's just basically the Wild West. Now, the state's approach, we think, is the one that is the most protective property owners. Basically, what you do is you look at all of state law. You look at lot lines. You look at merger provisions. You look at everything that is just a legal thing under state law. And you determine whether the piece of property is a truly standalone piece of property. And once you determine that, that's it. There's no rebuttable presumption. There's no way to wiggle out of it. This is the most predictable, simple test that could be imagined. And it would allow both property owners and other stakeholders to plan into the future. And, you know, I think I'm quite comfortable with this approach because this was the approach that Justice Scalia floated in footnote 7 of his decision in Lucas. He said, what you need to do to determine what the parcel is to look at property owners' objectively reasonable expectations as shaped by state law. He didn't say just lot lines. He said all of state law. So the state's position is Justice Scalia was exactly right. You look at all of the state law, you identify the parcel, and that's it. Then you move on. There's no rebuttable presumption. There's no way for the government to wiggle out of it. That's what it is. So I think that that is why the state's position may not be good for the property owners in this case, because the state law is not on their side, because the merger provision that they voluntarily triggered is not on their side. But it would be outside of this very unique situation where the property owners took voluntary steps to trigger the state law provision. It would create an irrebuttable answer to what is the parcel question, which in the vast, vast majority of cases would favor the person who had a separately saleable, developable piece of land without regard to what land they owned next door. So anyways, that is kind of the state's general pitch, and I'm happy to take any questions that may be heard.
Okay, thanks very much to our experts. Quick note for James, I think there's some static or something coming from your line. So if you could be mindful of that for just a second. Okay, so I'm going to open the floor to questions now. In just a second, we're going to hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. And then after that, enter star and then the pound key to request the floor. And we're going to field questions the order in which they're received. While we wait for some questions to queue up, I'll just lead off with my own. Something that stood out to me in the argument this morning was there seemed to be a lot of disagreement about what exactly the role Palo Zolo v. Rhode Island played and the extent to which it does or doesn't set precedent. I think Jim hit on that really briefly, but Misha, I'd love to hear the state of Wisconsin's thoughts on the role that case may have played.
Right. I think it's very interesting. Our understanding of Palenzolo was that if there is an unreasonable government action, and by unreasonable I mean an uncompensated taking at time one, and then Later, the property changes hands. The new property owner, basically as successor in interest, can bring that sort of claim. And our view is, in this case, if you want to do a true Palenzolo claim, what you have to do is look back at what happened originally, which is that the parents owned lot E and they didn't own lot F. So they were completely protected by the grandfather clause. So if the Murrs wanted to bring a Palenzolo type claim, what they would need to do is look back to what happened in 1976 and litigate whether that was a taking. Now, of course, as we pointed out in our brief, they don't want to do that because the grandfather clause would make that takings claim highly unlikely to succeed because the takings clause, of course, protected the parents. What we saw the Murrs is trying to do is the opposite of Palenzolo, which is to use the transfer of property to create a takings claim that never existed in the prior owner. So we think that what was being urged here was the opposite of Palenzolo, not Palenzolo. And as we said in our brief, if they want to bring a Palenzolo claim, if they want to say that what happened to the parents in 1976 was a taking, they're free to file that claim. And we never had any response in the reply brief or anything as whether they want that claim. And I think it's because they know that that wouldn't succeed because of the grandfather clause.
Well, indeed, there was no taking back in 1976 because the two lots were separately owned at that point in time. And why would you bring a taking claim? Because you could, at that time, sell the property separately. It wasn't until the two properties were owned by the same individuals, and for purpose of this case, that happened, or this discussion, that happened in 1995. It was at that time that the Murr children allegedly could not use the property separately. And what our point about Palenzolo is that the only reason that Anthony Palenzolo was not able to bring his taking claim initially was because the state said, when you, Anthony Palenzolo, acquired this property in your personal capacity, then you were subject to all the prior regulations and your property rights had diminished. You did not have the same rights in the property that the prior owner did. And in this case, we have essentially the same thing. When the children acquired the property themselves in 1995, because they happened to acquire the adjacent lots, they no longer had the same rights that the prior owners in the property did. Their lots, their property interests were severely diminished by now they could not sell this lot separately, and they could not use the property separately. They couldn't build on it. About all they could do is give it away. And so we think that was a fundamental nature, fundamental change in the nature of the property right by losing the ability to sell the lot separately. And that's why Palenzolo is front and center.
Well, I mean, let me just push back on that a little bit more. That, I think, is what the council said for the Murrs today at argument is they are bringing the claim based on what happened in 1976. And I think what we just heard there is that's not true. They're bringing the claim as to what happened in 1995. That means they're not bringing a Palenzolo-style claim as their parents' successor in interest. They're bringing a claim on their own rights of what happened in 1995. But we have a state court decision that says that they never got an unmerged lot E and F. There was never a point in the history of this litigation or the history of this property where somebody owned lot E and F at the same time and they were unmerged. The moment of acquisition, the property is merged. Now, the Murr's complaint is they want to unmerge the property. That's fair enough. They can bring that sort of takings claim, but it's not a Palenzolo claim. It's a claim as to their own interest. And so in order to define the relevant property, you've got to look at what did they take title to under state law. And it is crystal clear from state law, from Wisconsin state law, that they took title to just a single merged lot. They didn't take title to two separate lots.
Well, you know, obviously we're not going to agree on this, but I would say that they still had two lots. You say that they were merged, but the court below used a very clever term by saying, well, they were effectively merged. Because traditionally under merger, the lot lines get erased in the two parcels for all purposes. What you go down to the title, the records, the title for records down in the courthouse, you see that there is one lot where there used to be two. But here, if you go down to the courthouse, you're still going to find that there are two lots. with the lot line between the two of them as real as it was in the 1959 when this property was first subdivided and they were put into separate plotted properties. So, you know, again, I think we're going to disagree with the timing on this, but I think bottom line is that when the Murr family had these properties joined together in 1995, pursuant to the 1976 regulations, they were denied an essential and critical element of their property right that heretofore they had. So I think Palazzolo is relevant, and of course we'll see what the court does. And this is, of course, especially important in this case is because, as I said earlier, Justice Kennedy decided the Palazzolo case, and he is a little cryptic of where he is on this case. I couldn't really get a good feel for that. And his opinion is going to be essential because, of course, we have the usual split in many of these cases, four on one side, four on the other. And his opinion is going to be critical. And I'm hoping that he will find that Palazzolo should be interpreted as broadly as he wrote it.
Once again, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. While we wait on questions, let me make one quick programming note. The next Teleforum call will be tomorrow, March 21st at 3 o'clock. That's a Courthouse Steps Teleforum on Impression Products v. Lexmark International. And Professor David Olson, Associate Professor at the Boston College Law School, will be on our call. And with that, let's go to our first audience question.
Hi, my name is Don Padu. I'm a lawyer in practice in Washington, D.C. If lots E and F are deemed to have been merged by the Supreme Court, would the Murrs still have a takings claim because the larger merged property is worth less than the two separate properties would have been if they'd been kept separate?
This is Jim Burling. I can answer that. I'll start with answering that question. I mean, anybody can bring a taking claim, but because the diminution in value as determined by the appraisers below was only about 9%, it would be a very difficult taking claim to prevail on, and one that we think is it wouldn't do the Murrs any good by selling this property because if they sold the properties together, they wouldn't have the cabin that the family loves. If they are able to sell the Lot E separately, then they can raise the money they need to fix that cabin up.
If 9% is too low a diminution, do you have a sense where the line is?
Nobody knows where the line is. Enough is enough. I mean, we have cases where there has been a 90% diminution and the courts have found no taking. We have cases where there's been a 60% diminution and the courts have found a taking. It's a very imprecise standard and one that I wish that the court would clear up at some point in time.
Thanks.
Yes, I am in complete agreement with that. And, you know, one of the state's primary points today, which I think I was able to get across, is that the answer to the predicate question of what is a parcel should be crystal clear, because this area of law is such a mess. It's so hard to know. And if we get a test like the federal government urges of anything goes, then you basically have two completely unguided inquiries. But also with respect to my friends at the Pacific Legal Foundation, if we get a test like they urge, you're still going to have two completely undefined inquiries because if it's a rebuttable presumption for lot lines, it can be rebutted. And there's no limit that was articulated either in the briefs or today of what could be used to rebut it. So you would have kind of a guided inquiry, but still an all things considered inquiry at step one. And then you'd have the completely indefinite Penn Central inquiry at step two, which is why the state really wanted the court to adopt a bright line rule by looking at all of property rights and property laws under the state with no ability to rebut that.
Of course,
I don't know that the court was welcoming to that. I think a couple of the justices wanted a bright line rule, but it seemed like most of them wanted to retain some flexibility. Although I was kind of heartened that even Justice Justice Kagan and Sotomayor wanted to at least acknowledge the primacy and importance of state law. So while they didn't want to adopt a bright line rule, they at least wanted to provide some more guidance. But I think it would be much better to have a bright line rule with no ability to rebut any presumptions. Just state law, the source of real property rights, should define what is a parcel. That's the state's submission.
And I could agree to a point that a bright line rule can make some sense if that bright line law looks at what the plot, the deed is, and then other considerations of state law, such as the nature of the regulation, go to the takings question. However, I think it would be going too far with this court to argue for a bright line rule that you look only at the nature of the title, because there are instances where you could have a tiny postage stamp-sized parcel. This sometimes happens in resort areas, where building on a property would be inappropriate because it would be a nuisance. There may be inadequate septic. It may be on a cliff. It may be on unstable ground. There may be times when owner of several postage stamp-sized lots only has the right to put a non-nuisance use to that property if they are joined together. So having a bright line rule that you look only at the lot lines and you never look at some of the other factors is probably a bit too far. But the bright line rule urged by the state that you look at all property together conflates and mixes up the questions that deal with defining the parcel and the questions of determining whether or not there's been a regulatory taking. The state's land use regulation that essentially says you cannot develop one property if you own the one next door is a land use regulation. It doesn't in and of itself affect the title to the property. It doesn't affect the deed to the property. It doesn't affect what you're going to look at when you go down to the courthouse to look the property up. That's a question of whether or not there's been a taking. That's where you look either at the Lucas-style takings, where it's all use and value has been destroyed by the regulation, or you look at it in terms of a Penn Central taking, where you look at a whole variety of factors determining whether or not the impact has been so harsh, what use and value is left of the property, what's the nature of the government regulation. So, you know, I would agree that some bright line test could make sense, but not a bright line test that brings in those factors that are looked at for determining whether or not there's a taking. That's the second part of the analysis.
Well, so
okay,
I'd just like to just make one. So, go ahead. I'll take another question.
No, there's the lines are wide open, so you can,
okay,
you can so,
so
go
me,
ahead.
Let me respond to that, because this is a major theme of the Pacific Legal Foundation's argument in this case, which I think just misunderstands Wisconsin law. The land division ordinance in St. Croix County is right next to the zoning ordinance. They have exactly the same legal weight. They are of equal import in defining what is the property of state law. If you go on the St. Croix County website, you go pull it up, Google St. Croix County ordinance. Those two ordinances are right next to each other. The fact that the lot line still exists between lot E and lot F has absolutely no legal relevance under Wisconsin law. Absolutely no legal relevance under Wisconsin law. If tomorrow the MERS went down and deleted that lot line, there is not a single right they would gain or lose. It is a historical artifact of no meaning. So the only reason it hasn't been erased is because no one would bother to erase it. Because what is property for? It's to use it, it's to sell it, it's to develop it. In light of the merger, there is all of those things can be done the same, whether there is that lot line, which is, again, a complete historical artifact, and as a matter of Wisconsin law, has absolutely no remaining meaning.
Seeing no more questions on the line, I'll just turn it back over to our experts if either of you have any closing thoughts for us.
It's sort of too bad that we're holding this teleforum on the same day that Justice Gorsuch, soon to be Justice Gorsuch, is going through his confirmation hearing. Otherwise, we could have had a lot more calls in this case. But I think the bottom line here is that we are looking at property owners that are being treated differently solely because they own an adjacent lot. And yes, you can have two ordinances that are next to each other, but that doesn't mean they do the same thing. I do not believe that the ordinances in the state law setting up the nature of property divisions and the subdivision laws are just an artifact of an old time, because that means anybody owning property just has an artifact when they consider their lot lines in the deeds. I think that to do justice in this case, justice in some other cases, that property owners who own lots adjacent to one another should not be subject to a forced merger provision, a forced effective merger provision, as in this case, because, as I said before, this is not a real merger. It was an effective merger, according to the court. And what the merge ultimately wants to do is be able to sell one lot, get around $400,000 for it, and use that money to repair the cabin they have. Otherwise, they are essentially land rich and cash poor and have a cabin that is growing increasingly inadequate for the growing size of the property, of the family, and has issues because it's close to a flood zone and has on occasion flooded out. So they need to do things to this property. They can't do them, so the only remedy the state and county are giving them is to sell both lots together and go somewhere else. I don't think that's right. I don't think that the law of takings was designed to favor some property owners over others by accident of title issues, or in this case, because they're not wealthy enough to use both lots together.
I will just say that, like I said at the beginning, I think the Pacific Legal Foundation does really important work for property owners. Outside of the unique facts of this case, where the provision was triggered by the voluntary actions of the plaintiffs, I don't think that we're going to have too many bottom-line disagreements in too many cases. And I hope that the court rules in our favor here, but I hope that the court also announces a rule that provides guidance and that's broadly protective of property owners, because that is something that the Wisconsin Department of Justice and Pacific Legal Foundation share in touting the importance of that.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I would like to thank both of our experts for joining us today. Again, please join us for our next teleforum tomorrow at 3 p.m. That's a Courthouse Steps teleforum on impression products via Lexmark International with Professor David Olson. Thanks so much for joining us, and with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.